Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I have the pleasure of speaking today with Dr. Brian Hatcher. He is a professor of religious studies at Tufts University. We will be speaking on his exciting new book, Hinduism Before Reform. Hello, Brian. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Raj. How about you?
I'm doing well as well. Apparently, the world is joining us in terms of having wheelings and dealings online the way we are right now. So it's a good time to be doing stuff remotely.
It does seem to be, unfortunately.
Interesting, because most of my interactions with clients and colleagues and interviewees are online on Zoom as we are now, or over the phone. So oddly enough, I don't have to change too much of my stomping grounds.
That's right.
For your book, there's so much in there. It's hard for me to gauge how much background our audience would have on how we think of Hinduism, like how we think of modern Hinduism, how we teach Hinduism. Yeah. And so I'd rather do a little bit of review for those who are acquainted with that rather than leave folks lost in the dark, because that what you and I take for granted as scholars of Hinduism, mm-hmm. A lot of others may not be in on that narrative. And without understanding that narrative, we can't understand the significance of what you're trying to do.
Exactly.
So maybe counterintuitively, you could tell us the narrative that maybe you're problematizing. So before this book, how would we be teaching Hinduism or modern Hinduism?
Yeah. So I think one sort of easy way into answering that is to think about standard textbook treatments of either it could be the history of South Asia or modern South Asia in particular, or it could be the modern Hinduism textbook, or more broadly, Hinduism textbooks. All of these, when they treat the historical development of modern Hinduism, they typically have run through the classical and what we might call post-classical period, what we might call pre-modern Hinduism. And we've reviewed, you know, classical patterns of devotional theism and temple worship and gone on into pre-modern bhakti movements and all of this. And then we usually come up smack dab on the year 1800, and we introduce Ram Mohan Roy as the father of modern India, the first religious reformer in India. And then when you look at a lot of these textbook treatments, they tend to skip rapidly from the advent of Ram Mohan Roy and the establishment of the Brahmo Samaj in the early 19th century as a pattern of enlightened, reformed, morally articulated vision of Hinduism, to the late 19th century with the advent of someone like Sri Ramakrishna and then his disciple Swami Vivekananda. And we get quickly into the 20th century from there to Mahatma Gandhi and on to the project of the freedom movement and independence for the Indian nation state. And what I tend to feel happens is a number of important developments are elided in that jump from Ram Mohan to the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. That is, a whole century's worth of really consequential developments are skipped over in any detailed sense. But secondly, also there's a kind of presumed narrative about modernity and the relationship between the kinds of Hinduism that will be relevant for the shaping of the modern Indian state. And that tends to be a kind of liberal vision of Hinduism as freed from the shackles of ritual and priestcraft and restraint and opened up into the world of freedom and reason and enlightenment. So there's a narrative there about what true Hinduism can look like under the right conditions of modernity. Sometimes in older colonialist treatments, that's linked obviously to the enlivening, if you will, influence of European culture and British traditions in particular. But even so, it factors in nationalist narratives as well as the kind of reforming of a tradition toward an appropriate mode of religion for an independent secular nation state. So what I'm trying to do is just problematize that narrative while also opening up the 19th century for a bit more careful historical study. And if I can say one more thing on that, what the book really does, and it's in part an answer to the problematic I've just sketched, but also perhaps not a complete rectification of the problem, is the book zeroes in on the early 19th century. In fact, the last quarter of the 18th and the first quarter of the 19th century as what I call the period of the early colonial. And one of my, you know, chief goals in the book is to indicate that that period is radically different from the period of the late colonial. If we think of the conditions shaping the world of a Swami Vivekananda in the late 19th century, those conditions were very different from what shaped the world of a Rama Mohan Roy in the early colonial period. So one of my goals is to suggest that far from skipping over the 19th century, as if we can jump from Rama Mohan to Vivekananda in one easy swoop, we need to slow down and think about the 100 years separating these two men, or nearly 100 years, and the kinds of changes that took place from the early to the late colonial. So that's a sub-theme in the book that maybe we can talk about as we go along.
So that's a good sort of 30,000-foot view of what you're engaging. Now, just let's hone in on this figure, Ram Mohan Roy. And before we talk too much about the insights you provide with your work, how is he understood? Why is this figure so important in how we understand and teach Hinduism generally?
Yeah, I want to introduce right here the comparative framework of the book, just to indicate to the readers the ways in which the book tries to get away from thinking of Ram Mohan as the starting point, which we're doing here now, and it's entirely understandable, particularly in relationship to the way in which you rightly suggest, let's think about what you're trying to correct before we go on to thinking about what the correction looks like. But part of the problem is we loop immediately back into talking in the ways we're accustomed to talking about, beginning with Ram Mohan Roy again. So, I mean, the book is premised on an insight I had that struck me rather profoundly, that Ram Mohan Roy is exactly contemporaneous in his dates, nearly exactly, with the figure of Sahajanand Swami, the founder of the Swaminarayan Sampradaya in early colonial Gujarat. So it struck me we have two figures at the head of two immensely important modern Hindu organizations who arise at the same time and articulate what look to be very different visions of modern Hinduism. So it immediately suggested to me a way to bring Sahajanand Swami into the picture, but also then to throw our understanding of Ram Mohan into a slightly different angle of attack, if you will. So in that sense, so then we can go back and think about how do we imagine Ram Mohan typically. Well, the operative metaphor typically is the father of modern India, right? That he is the person we associate with the arrival of a reasoned analysis of scripture, the articulation of a critique of so-called quote-unquote medieval Hinduism as polytheistic, based in image worship, and framed by the authority of Brahmanical priestly ritual. So he's the figure of liberal emancipation, if you will, who opens up a pathway for Hindus to be Hindu without being enmeshed in the sort of frameworks of pre-modern Hindu religious practice and theology. So he's the forerunner, the pathfinder for what an emancipated modern religion will look like in India. So we have a lot to do to unthink him in that role in some ways. Although my goal is not to tarnish Ram Mohan's legacy or to cast doubt on what he accomplished. It's simply to reframe him, to find a different way to think about his originality, if you will. And again, by doing that in comparison to the figure of Sahajanand Swami in Gujarat.
So then I think you've pretty much already answered this, but through your comparison of these two figures, what is the primary goal or argument of Hinduism before reform?
I guess what I'm concerned with, if you've noticed already, I've used a lot of tropes and the rhetoric of liberal religion, which are themselves kind of framed in terms of a basically Protestant or quasi-Protestant critique of Roman Catholic religion, if you will, as the emancipation from priestcraft, the questioning of ritual, the primacy of spirit over law. All these tropes have come to shape the ways in which we think of the modernity of the Brahmo Samaj founded by Ram Mohan as being sort of consonant with or congruent with a liberal vision of modern rational progressive religion. And I'm simply trying to say, while those things may not be untrue about the Brahmo Samaj, they also encode a kind of analytic and normative set of judgments that bear our scrutiny because they lead us into certain avenues of, political and social judgments about other types of religion. And in this case, the foil is the Swami Narayan Sampradaya, which is today probably one of the most visible forms of diasporic Hinduism and a very operative mode of Hinduism in India as well, but can be construed as looking all too familiar as a kind of quote-unquote traditionalist, guru-based, image-worshipping Vaishnava kind of Hinduism. So can be seen as problematic from the standpoint of this prototypical liberal religion that we associate with Ram Mohan Roy. So a goal of the book is to find another way to think about the way modern Hinduism sort of gets off the ground in the early colonial period in relation to the conditions on the ground in the early colonial moment, to find a way to compare two hugely important movements without having the comparison rest upon a normative judgment about one's modernity and the other's backwardness, if you will. I don't know if I got lost in my own explication there, so that may not have made much sense.
No, this is the scenic route. I mean, there are a lot of ideas and there are a lot of points of engagement. I mean, so many directions. So let me just stay more focused on the book for a quick moment before we speak more creatively. What's your data? What's your methodology? What are you looking at to craft your arguments?
Well, primarily I'm looking at the life histories, and we can think of those as hagiographies and also biography/autobiography. More hagiography in the case of Sahajanand Swami, more history and even some snippets of autobiography in the case of Ram Mohan. I'm looking in particular at evidence about the conditions on the ground, and one part of the book is to frame a comparison of what's happening in the eastern region and in Gujarat. So in Bengal and Gujarat are compared in the early colonial moment for thinking about the conditions on the ground, trying to correct again some presumptions about what happens with the advent of modernity in India by way of presuppositions about there being a radical break under British rule away from chaos and anarchy towards a kind of stability and enlightenment brought through the agency under the aegis of British imperial rule. So I'm looking at a lot of historical data from Gujarat and Bengal to try to sketch two frontiers, if you will, of religious change, show what they share, but also how they're distinctive and how they then can help us situate those lives of Sahajanand Swami and Ram Mohan in their context. And then finally, I'm trying to look at evidence about what I call polity formation. That is, I try to avoid speaking of either the Swami Narayan Sampradaya or the Brahmo Samaj as religious movements, because the overarching goal of the book is to try to talk about modern Hinduism without invoking the idioms and tropes of reform. And the idea of the modern religious reform movement is so pervasive that I have to engage in a really aggressive attempt not to use that language. So what I choose to do is think about these two figures as early colonial creators of religious polities. And to do this, I try to use the evidence from within both the Brahmo Samaj project and the Swami Narayan project of scripturalization and hermeneutics to make sense of how these two men promulgated their polities through the articulation of the meaning of scripture and their own authority as what I call ruling lords or masters.
So through this counterintuitive yet fascinating comparison, so tell us, what have you found in comparing these two men? In what ways are they analogs? In what ways are they not?
Well, I mean, obviously, the most compelling thing to strike me early on was the fact of their near contemporaneous dates. So Sajjanan born 1781 and Ramohan born 1772 or perhaps 1774, 76, we don't know for sure. Both dying within 2 or 3 years of one another, Sajjanan dying in 1830 and Ramohan dying in 1833 in Britain, of course. So their dates are nearly exactly contemporaneous. The worlds they inhabited, I argue, were cognate insofar as rather than being either of them located in contexts of chaos, anarchy, and the degradation of medieval Hinduism, were actually worlds of rich economic, social, and political change, and worlds which therefore provided all sorts of avenues for what I'd call rather savvy and canny, almost religious entrepreneurs in a way to take advantage of the context on the ground to advance their agendas. I've lost the train of my thought there. Your question again.
Essentially, yeah. I was asking you as general as possible. Asking you the general question as to what extent they were analogs and to what extent they were not, so that you could have leeway to share some of your findings.
Yeah. So that's sort of the over the course of the book, a good deal of work is done to sketch what they share as what I call early colonial religious lords. So this will itself be perhaps problematic to many to think of Ramohan as a kind of a lordly figure, maybe problematic to some, but I try to sketch the ways in which at a functional level, using the work of Ron Inden and Amrita Shodhan and others, I try to show the ways in which we can think of their mastery as cognate. That is, they are ruling lords who convene around them certain kinds of courts that are framed around their authority and in relation to the promulgation of new norms and rules about conduct, two different frameworks, obviously. So I begin with the similarities of what they do by way of promulgation of polities, and I end the book with reflecting, okay, now I've tried to show what these two men share, but let's not forget that they also created two very different polities. So by the end of the book, I'm trying to think about how those polities differed, and both in their moment and in their eventual trajectories toward subsequent 19th century and 20th century history. So there we come up against a problem that I've already alluded to, which is what do we have now to say, having reviewed what they share by way of their moment and their sort of agency as polity promulgators, what do we have to say now about what appear to be still radical differences between the movements that they created, between a guru-based devotional sampradaya and what looks to be more scripturally oriented liberal project of religious change in the form of the Brahmo Samaj. And so I end the book by suggesting there are important differences in that. The satsang, the community of fellowship created by Sajjanan Swami, is relatively internally based, communitarian project based on following of rules enacted by the guru and enshrined in the authority of his successors, and to some degrees maintained through projects of self-control, but also through communal surveillance and internal monitoring of behavior, whereas the Brahmo Samaj looks more like a group that erred less on that kind of communitarian solidarity and more on a kind of shared ethic that would shape social life in a public sphere that became more disseminated in terms of an aspirant middle class in places like Kolkata originally and then expanding outward from there, leading to a situation in which the Brahmo ethic becomes almost, as David Koff put it, synonymous with what he called the modern Indian mind. So we have, and this again brings us back to the fundamental tension in the scholarship between the two movements, which is the apparent appearance that the Brahmo Samaj looks entirely congruent with a kind of modern liberal public sphere, whereas the Swaminarayan Sampradaya looks like the risk to that liberal public sphere from a sampradayic, that is communalist, conservative, tradition-based movement that's more insular and perhaps whose values are shielded and in some cases could possibly be antithetical to the project of liberal religion in India. So that's again, 30,000 feet and sort of ending where I end after a lot of sort of analysis of the two polities.
So comment on the difference between these two figures are operating in two ecosystems, one at the center of imperial presence and one on the periphery, as you know in your book. So maybe comment on how that comes to bear on their respective projects.
Yeah, I'm playing with spatial tropes as much as tropes about reform, and the center periphery is an important one to think through. Obviously, places like Kolkata are figured as the epicenters of religious reform in India. And so I speak about standard narratives of religious change in India being predicated on the idea of reform spreading outward from a center like Kolkata and expanding inexorably across India and involving more and more regions in the project of modernity. And in part, I want to fight against that that trope by way of showing, again, this goes to their contemporaneity on two different sides of the subcontinent, that two kinds of religious polity construction were taking place simultaneously, and neither were, we don't need the narratives of modern progress and even imperial progress to make sense of what these two men accomplished in their lifetimes. We can ground them instead in the changes that were relevant within the two spheres in which they operated, and then come back again and think about what it means to say one man operated on the periphery and one man was in the center. Because one of the standard ways to make sense of these two men has been to say that, well, we can understand Ram Mohan's modernity because he came so directly in contact with British colonial actors that he was necessarily shaped by the British project of enlightenment, but also the Christian project of reform. Whereas Sahajanand Swami was on the periphery, had no real contact with European civilizing mission, and therefore we can understand why he remained quote-unquote traditionalist. But as it turns out, as I try to show, Sahajanand Swami was, perhaps you can't make the case that he was as directly engaged with colonial actors as Ram Mohan Roy was. Obviously, Ram Mohan ended up traveling to Britain and dying there in his relationship with Unitarians and with British figures of authority. But if you look at the evidence from diaries and from the community itself, it's clear that Sahajanand Swami was very clear of the imperial presence in Gujarat and was not averse to taking advantage of that presence in order to foster his own goals by way of the security of this new polity that he was fashioning. So I try to suggest that both men were working to insert polities into what I call an imperial scale of forms. That is, there was an emerging new imperial formation under the form of the British that was making its presence felt in both regions in different ways, but to go over against which each man tried to institute his polity and secure its welfare by asking for assistance or working in concert with British authority. So I end the book by saying that in the end, neither is more modern than the other because of their contact with, greater or lesser contact with the British. That was a factor in both figures' lives. But of course, the differences emerge in what they did with the conditions on the ground and what their theological programs led them to institute by way of social norms and religious values.
Would you say that, I imagine you would agree that in the case of Ram Mohan Roy, his life and work was more directly impacted or shaped by colonial presence?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, as I say, we can't deny that. He's active in what Peter Marshall called a bridgehead the Imperial Bridgehead in Kolkata. I mean, he's deeply influenced from an early age by his contacts with various residents and his work with factors and other people under the British administration. So there's no way in which we can say that he isn't the more deeply entwined with British rule. But I don't want the question of the nature of the two polities to depend on the greater or lesser mathematics or arithmetic of who was, you know, more exposed to British culture. I don't think that's necessarily the right answer to understanding the nature of the two polities or framing comparison between them, because it leads too easily to the assumption again that, oh, Ramohans was necessarily the more modern, the more advanced, and the more liberal by virtue of that greater contact, whereas Sahajanand's is destined to be rated as backward.
And so it's obvious that you are contributing to the history of ideas or understanding of a historical epoch. Do you consider in your work or thought how your findings bear on self-identification, how Hindus himself may regard what Ram Mohan Roy was doing in that historical moment?
I want to make sure I understand your question. Are you asking whether I'm aware of how Indians themselves or members of these movements in particular have framed the story of their own leaders?
It seems to me that you're shedding light or attempting to shed light on a specific epoch in history.
Yeah.
Roughly the life and works of these two figures, these two lords, as you would say, rather than reformers. So let me circle back at the outset. Yeah. If memory serves, at the outset of your introduction.
And I'm not trying to be evasive here. I just want to make sure what you're asking. Yeah.
I get you loud and clear. At the outset of your introduction, I believe it is, or first chapter, you talk about risk and that going down this road of intellectual discovery is a risk that you're taking. And if I'm not mistaken, it's a risk of you take the risk of upsetting people. So tell me a little bit more about that. How do you think, what is that? What do you mean by that?
Well, there are a number of risks. The risk to my own reputation would be to dare in the scholarly, to dare to risk upsetting the scholarly consensus around a figure like Ram Mohan Roy by treating him as a lord rather than a modern liberal reformer. So the risk is to will people think I've lost my mind or am arguing something that's just patently untrue? And I make the point in the book that, you know, it's not often we hear him referred to as King Ram Mohan, but there I did come across one reference where an Indian author who referred to him as King Ram Mohan, and I thought, well, of course he did, because Raja is our standard translation for Raja as king. And we tend to forget, these are titles bestowed on his family and bestowed on him by the emperor when he headed off to Britain. But it points towards something that's not insignificant, which is that there's a lordship about the man. And so I try to frame his lordship in terms of an Indo-Persian world in which he manifested a kind of authority as a ruling lord. And so I take a risk of bringing that forward. And I can imagine Brahmos in particular being troubled by the idea that their egalitarian, liberal-minded, progressive reformers being treated as an authoritarian religious leader or lord in the non-religious sense even. So there's a risk there. I think there's another risk in view of this consensus again about the story about modern Hinduism and the story of modern India. And here I use Martha Nussbaum as a foil in the book. In the introduction, I look at her book, The Crisis Within, from 2007, which she wrote in the wake of the Godra incident and the pogrom against Muslims in Gujarat, where she zeroes in on what's up in Gujarat, what's the problem in Gujarat, and what's up with these Hindus who are murdering Muslims in the name of a kind of Hindutva. And she zeroes in even more particularly in one chapter on the Swami Narayan Sampradaya by visiting a mandir in Illinois in a kind of mode of underground surveillance to see, you know, what are these people up to, as if she's going into the inner sanctum of a cult or a esoteric sect, and she's going to expose the strange deluded thinking of these radical religious zealots. So I risk, and her story in that book makes perfect sense in terms of the narrative I'm trying to problematize. That is India's struggle with religion. I think that was the title of maybe Jerry Larson book, has been the struggle to emancipate religious life and spirituality from the shackles of tradition and priestly authority. Well, so if you follow that narrative, her analysis of Swaminarayan Sampradaya makes perfect sense, and we come away in her vision celebrating the Brahmo poetry of Rabindranath Tagore and the modern Indian nation and looking askance at the Swaminarayanis. So I'm taking a big risk in saying, well, let's not write them off that quickly, and let's not use this rather crude tool of reform-based tropes to say that they represent inherently or historically the kind of risk she poses them to be in the book. So there's a risk there, right?
So there's this notion. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
There's this notion. You're driving at this notion that somehow this idea that the Brahmo Samaj movement may somehow be more valid, if you will, or than the Swaminarayan movement. In whom do you think this ethos is prevalent?
A lot of us in the study of Hinduism, I think, are.
I mean more
by it, and it's also you mean in a more
I'm wondering if is this in your view is that notion equally prevalent among practicing Hindus as well as scholars of Hinduism?
Well, this is the moment we're facing right now. Of course, I mean, this is what makes the recourse to Nussbaum's book so useful and so telling, is that, you know, when she was writing, she couldn't predict that Modi would end up becoming the prime minister of India. At the time she's writing, he was chief minister of Gujarat, and at the time he had been, you know, denied a visa to enter the United States and all of that in the wake of the Gojra violence. And now we've gone through Howdy Modi, and we've got the fellowship of Trump and Modi, and we see what the Hindutva movement is doing. It's going from strength to strength, apparently, on an electoral basis and on the basis of the ratcheting up of public hatred and resentment towards Muslims and others, right? So, there's a backlash, if you will. And this goes to the further risk that you were asking about. There's a risk in writing a book like this, that I'll look as if I'm here to defend a kind of conservative Hinduism. The last thing I want is to be seen as an apologist for Hindutva. I'm not making the case, let's be clear, I'm largely focused on the early colonial moment, and I disavow any claim to be able to see the narrative connection between what happens in 1820 and what we're facing today. But obviously they are clearly related, and they're hugely significant given the current political moment. So I'm running the risk of perhaps being seen as, oh, here's someone coming along questioning the fundamental values of a liberal democratic nation state that's pledged itself to the goals of secularism, and bringing forward, as if it were on an equal plane with the Brahmo vision, the Swaminarayan vision of a divinely sanctioned religious universe. I guess in defense of the risk I'm taking, I would say is, you know, we know now that the vision of secularism itself is grounded in a particular view of religion, right? So we're finding ourselves as a discipline in religious studies and as scholars of Hinduism in particular, having to think through the major categories we use to make sense of our modern history and to think about the sort of normative and political consequences of the way we talk about religion. And I think what I try to strive for is I'm just looking for a frame, as I put it, a kind of analytical framework within which we can compare the origins of these two polities without presuming superiority or the modernity of the one over the other. Let's do that. Let's think about them at the level of polity analysis. And then from there, we can decide how these things took shape, what conditions have played into the success and their duration over time. And then we can think through about how this has ramifications for the contemporary political landscape.
You know, it seems to me that strangely, in probably a positive way, positive sense, that what you're trying to make sense of in the early modern Hindu context, there's certainly an analog in terms of recent politics on the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's an analog of running the risk of the narrative being launched in an echo chamber that's self-validating.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't quite take into account of what's beyond that echo chamber, and dismissing or othering it, whether within Hinduism, whether across religions, whether nation states. This idea, no one would have guessed, for example, the results of the 2016 election.
Hmm.
Nobody that I would have spoken to.
Yeah.
I'm obviously not heavily involved in American politics being...
No, most of us were really surprised, right? Yeah.
Right. And so, but that tells you something. That tells you something very, very important about the echo chamber that's being crafted by a self-validating narrative. And I think that is common to, I think, all tribes, all stripes, all ideologies, all peoples. It's only exasperated in our times. So for example, even in the way we study Hinduism, you know, I had the great fortune of teaching a course called Popular Hinduism that my then advisor, Elizabeth Rollman, had created. She's also a textualist.
Mm-hmm.
But the importance of teaching, you know, puja, tirtha, possession, festivals, the festival calendar, sacred time and space. It's the lifeblood of practitioners, and yet can be so outside of the echo chamber of Sanskrit narrative.
Right.
Right. And I think that principle applies to what you're saying between the Swaminarayan movement and the Brahma Samaj movement.
Yeah.
And I think that principle is not, what I'm driving at is that you are touching on a problem that's pervasive in the human experience, but you're shedding light on the problem and looking at a specific historical cultural moment that I think needs to be problematized. And I think anybody who's confused about why politics are the way they are today may want to pay careful attention to how we understand our narrative of politics past.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm inclined to say I agree. And in fact, you know, were it not for an agreement with the press about word length, I had written a book with 30,000 more pages attached to it, in which many of which I tried to wrestle with the contemporary. I tried to venture into my own thoughts on what is the solution to this tension between a kind of communally based, what you can call forms of popular religion, which are immensely valid and meaningful to people in a variety of, not just a Swaminarayan context, but any number of devotional movements and contexts, and the vision of a kind of world of plural, democratic, social and political life that's respective of human rights and norms of justice. So I couldn't do all that in the book. I ended up having to leave that off. And I basically end the book by saying both polities, if you will, need to be held to account for different kinds of sins of omission and commission, I guess we could say. If the one takeaway from the Brahmo side might be, you know, we, in many ways, the Brahmos get a pass from too much critical reflection. They, if you read Martha Dustbaum, there's not a lot to be concerned about with the Brahmo vision. But the Brahmos were a largely high caste, movement that was based in a kind of middle class aspirationalism that framed a certain bourgeois liberal project that excluded other groups, women, low caste, Muslims, etc. So they need to be held to account for that part of their history, right? By the same token, the Swaminarayanis have to find a way to insert their polity within the norms of a modern liberal secular nation state. And I actually refer in passing at the end to a verse in the Shikshapatri, which is one of the texts actually composed by Sahajanand Swami, a set of teachings or rules to guide the community, in which he says, you know, the sampradaya should conform itself to the norms of the landscape around it. And I think that's a simple rule that could be followed and taken as a kind of touchstone for the sampradaya to not fight against norms of liberal democratic public, but to insert themselves and actively integrate as best they can with that while honoring their own commitments to their guru and their Lord and the norms of satsang, or what I call the rule of life that they've all committed to as satsangis. But I think you framed it really well that way, that as much as this is, and I confess it's largely oriented to the early colonial moment, because I feel there's an important historical component to the book that needs to be brought forward just there, that this is a period we don't understand well enough. The number of scholars who are helping us now realize the uniqueness of this moment. So there's some justice simply in focusing on that moment, but there's also a longer durée that needs to be addressed, which is how we got from 1830 to 2020. And that hopefully will be, I'd like to think the book might open up those conversations and future research.
So speaking of future research, what are you working on now?
What I have in the works right now is a book that actually ends up informing a chunk of the current book, Hinduism Before Reform, which is, I become interested in the activities of the Dasnami Sampradaya, the Shaiva monastic community. It's a pan-Indian movement that we don't think of often so much in the context of Bengal. So if you look at Matthew Clark, wrote a very good survey of the Dasnami movement. The material on North India and even places like Hyderabad and the work of Karen Lennon and others, you can find evidence of the activity of the Dasnami sadhus in economic and political networks, in the work of what William Pinch called the warrior ascetics. But Bengal tends to not figure very actively in those historical discussions, in part because there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence for them. But what I began to find out in some recent field research that actually came about by working with a student who had a project, a Tufts student, and I mentored him in the field, came to realize there were a number of current and former Dasnami monastic sites scattered around Western Bengal that have kind of undergone transformations in the 20th century, certainly, but that point back to a time in the late 18th and early 19th century when the Dasnamis were quite active in Western Bengal and Bangladesh. And it struck me that there's a chance here to, again, tell a different story about religion in Bengal, because if you read the Bengali scholarship on these sites, they often remark that, well, these places are unusual because we don't do this sort of thing in Bengal. We don't build muttas like this. We don't have Dasnami sadhus. So these are not really part of our landscape. They're sort of alien to it. And yet what I have been exploring is the ways in which these Dasnamis effectively integrated themselves into the social, political, and economic life of Lower Bengal in the 19th century. And in the Hinduism Before Reform book, I use that some of that material in my chapter I call Fluid Landscapes, because I'm trying to, in that chapter, sketch a shared world. And I think this goes to your point about popular religions, tirthas and pujas and all that that you mentioned in the course that you taught. That Ram Mohan and Sahajanand shared a landscape and a cultural world, and they both moved through it, which is quite fascinating. One of the things they shared is early lives of peregrination, if you will. So before he became Sahajanand Swami, he was known as Nilakantha Varney, and he was a renouncer, taking the Shaivite renunciant name and traveling through the Himalayas, and I argue clearly down into eastern India and Bengal and current Bangladesh. In fact, one of the things I claim to show in the book is that it's very likely that he got as far as the region around Chittagong near the Myanmar border. There's some evidence in the Sanskrit Satsangi Jivanam that's we can almost definitively, I think, use to plant him in the landscape of far eastern India, which is quite fascinating because he's thought of as a Gujarati reformer, even though, of course, he's originally from the region of Ayodhya in North India. So what I'm showing is these men's worlds were far flung and shaped by a wide range of influences. And those influences had a lot to do with what you're calling popular religion. I try to picture Nilakantha Varney moving through a world shared with other sadhus, articulated around the authority of local ruling lords in relation to new temples that were popping up in the landscape around places like Bogra or in Sitakund Range in eastern Bangladesh. And Ram Mohan traveling to Benares and to studying in Patna, possibly getting as far as Tibet, he claims, but certainly probably Bhutan in northern Bengal. And his interactions then with an Indo-Islamic world, as well as encounters with Jains and Buddhists and others, all of which have shaped his religious worldview, but also, I say, became constituent parts of how he understood the articulation of his own ruling authority. So in terms of popular religion, I think there's a way in which we can ground these two men in their landscapes and learn something about lived religion in India in the late 18th and early 19th century that we don't often associate, particularly with a figure like Ram Mohan, who we think of as an urban colonial figure. So again, I've segued back to the book, but in the new book project, I don't have a title for it yet, but I want to explore some of the material sites, the extant monastic sites in Lower Bengal, some of which have perished, unfortunately, are in danger of decaying and being recovered by the surrounding jungle, but others remain active under new leadership, and often new community organizations have taken them over. Few of them remain actively Dasnami anymore, but they have their histories, and it's interesting to try to recover those. So that's something I'm working on now.
Well, it's perfectly fine that you've segued back into the book, because these conversations, as I mentioned at the outset, are the scenic route. I don't script these I don't script the interviews. There's much more, I think, creative exchange happening when one responds in the moment to what arises from one's interlocutor.
I appreciate that, yeah.
And so, isn't it interesting that these two figures, you know, these two figures with followings, whatever one wants to call them, lords, reformists, certainly they were figures with followings, impactful men of their times. Isn't it interesting that they both were wanderers, travelers, seekers of sorts, who came into contact with a variety of stripes and responded differently? To the plurality that they encountered.
Yeah.
Doesn't that sound awfully familiar? These two responses aren't old. Aren't new.
Aren't new, exactly.
the response to well, let's go back to the tradition to as a response to these the plurality of religious or spiritual practice is. Or, wait a minute, let's find a way to open up and make a little more space.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Well, and I appreciate there's a paradigmatic quality certainly to both of them, and there's a sense in which this is a set of themes we're familiar with. Those of us who work in religion in South Asia, we're familiar with this. And in the case of Sahajanand Swami, where we're working with, I work with the Sanskrit hagiographical text, the Satsangi Jivanam, which is a kind of Puranic text in its scope. It sort of aims to be Puranic, but it also aims to be a kind of a Dharma Shastra as well, a text on ethics and comportment. But that text has such a paradigmatic quality that we have to, of course, read it against the grain, that it's kind of a Digvijaya, you know, it's the young renouncer spanning the entire subcontinent and surpassing and overcoming all resistance to Vaishnava bhakti along the way, defeating tantrikas and yogis and other misguided forms of religion. So it's a text with a clear normative agenda. We have to read it very carefully, but it does, I'm convinced, it encodes some experiences that he passed on to his hagiographer. So these scenes in Eastern India, there are sites that correspond so clearly to what is discussed in the text that they go from the mythic to the historic rather quickly, even if the whole idea that he wandered from the Himalayan sacred sites like Badrinath all the way to Eastern India, down to Puri, down to Rameshwaram, and back up to Gujarat, you know, did his whole circumambulation of the subcontinent. That fits a perfect paradigm. And notice it fits the paradigm of what a conquering lord has to do in order to establish their sovereignty is conquer the four quarters. So this is part of how I say he's able to articulate, and the community articulates his lordship, is by telling the story of his conquest. Ramahans is, we don't have a hagiographic text like that, but we do have his own accounts of his travels, and they orient us less maybe to the paradigmatic Sanskrit norms and more to this Indo-Islamic world, and certainly a plural world in which it was important for him, given his family background, to know not just Sanskrit, but to know Persian and Arabic as well. And so, you know, I focus on his first well-known work, the Tufat al-Muwahhidin, the gift to monotheists, as a work that articulates his clear insertion into an engagement with Indo-Islamic learning. And that's something others have pointed out, but I try to bring it to the fore as helping us understand some of his ethos or some of his perhaps self-identity as a kind of a ruling lord who convenes a darbar around himself and uses that darbar as a forum from which to promulgate a new vision of religion and theology. So, these life stories are fascinating, and they're both paradigmatic, but I think there's history there too that we can recover.
Certainly. Before we sign off, was there anything that you had wanted to discuss about the book that we didn't touch on?
Well, I would want to say that book, you know, everything I do, I think I try to do too many things at once. It's a constitutional defect of my own character or something. I'm always trying to bounce or have too many balls juggling at the same time. So the book does a lot. One of the things, the before in the title, Hinduism Before Reform, is important to me. It's marking both an interpretive move and a kind of historical orientation. So the before means let's talk about Hinduism before we invoke the category of reform. So let's just try to find another way to talk about Hinduism without using the discourse of reform. So that's one element of the before. The other part of the before is let's talk about what was happening in India before what I call the empire of reform emerges in the latter 19th century, in which the British Empire self-consciously styles itself as a kind of reforming mission of progressive improvement of the subcontinent and begins to frame religion along these lines. So from the 1840s, certainly, but certainly after the mutiny and on towards the latter part of the 19th century, the discourse of reform becomes the almost all-encompassing framework within which to understand modalities of religion in modern India. So I'm saying let's go back before that. And in going back before it, I try to orient more to the pre-modern and think about issues of continuity between the early colonial and the pre-colonial, if you will, by way of showing, you know, let's not read, again, this goes back to the point I made earlier, let's not read Ramohan and Sahojanand through the lens of a late 19th century understanding of religion. Let's try to understand what their world shared with a kind of pre-colonial ethos of plurality, of lordship, of the promulgation of sampradayas or samajas within rather than competing against other forms of religious organization. So it's an attempt to think back. And I draw a lot on scholars who have been working of late on the pre-modern. And there's a lot of really good new history on a pre-modern South Asian, early modern. And I think that's important for scholars of modern Hindi to pay attention to, because we have this inevitable challenge of understanding the issue of change and continuity. The whole question of how much rupture was there with the advent of colonialism. How radically did things change circa 1800? And I'm trying to make the case in the lives of these two men that there's a lot there that we can see as being continuous with the pre-modern. And therefore, let's not rush to understand them against the litmus tests that were prominent and prevalent by the late 19th century. So that's the only other thing I'd want to probably bring forward.
Well, it occurred to me that it was a clever play in the title in terms of Hinduism before reform. It gives a sense of thinking of Hinduism beyond this idea of reform. So that's right. So you'll have to come back when your next book is out.
That'd be very nice. Thank you. I appreciate the invitation. I hope I haven't exhausted your patience today.
I assure you that I have more time on my hands today.
And this we all week. Do. Yeah, as we all do.
Not to worry.
I really appreciate it, Raj, because I feel sad that the book happened to appear right at the moment when everything shut down. And so I've been bemoaning the fact that it's hard to get word about the book out in a time of social isolation and distancing and all of that. So I'm grateful to you for the chance to talk a little bit about it.
Sure thing. And we'll send a note out in all of our circles that this interview is up, and that'll at least alert them to the book for when they're able to go back into bookstores.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
No problem. For all of you listening out there, I'm glad that you're able to listen and that you have some respite from thoughts of what's happening in the world. Until next time, stay safe and keep reading.